This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
Keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello and welcome. This is Gary Clinton, and I have the privilege of bringing to you tonight's episode of Night Transmission, the 72nd episode. Tonight we're going to start off with an episode from the Black Museum, which was a 1951 crime drama produced by Harry Allen Towns for the BBC. This program would also air in the United States on the Mutual Network between January the 1st of 1952 and December the 30th of 1952. This show dramatized true cases from the files of Scotland Yard's Black Museum, wherein the narrator, Orson Welles, we all know Orson Welles, would tell the story of a grisly murder accomplished by the agency of some everyday object. And this object had been preserved in Scotland Yard's Black Museum. Today's episode is called The Spotted Bedsheet. It's the story of James Cam and a body that he pushed through the porthole aboard the ocean liner, the Durban Castle. This happened off the west coast of Africa on October the 18th of 1947. And it happened to a minor actress of the time named Gay Gibson, who he had killed by strangulation. This episode takes some liberties with the facts, mostly regarding names. They don't call Gay Gibson, but Natalie Parsons, neither of which, by the way, are her birth name, which was Eileen Isabel Ronnie Gibson. Cam here is called Alan Birch. And the name of other people who were on the scene is also changed, as is the name of the liner. For some reason, they call the liner the Bengal Tower. I don't know why all of these changes were made, unless it's because the event was still quite recent, and British libel law is notoriously heavily weighted towards the plaintiff. Cam would be sentenced to death for the murder. However, the political situation in England at that time was in flux. The Parliament was debating the abolition of the death penalty, and all executions were suspended. Eventually, this parliamentary ruckus was resolved with the resumption of hanging. Still, however, Cam did not hang, but was released from prison on license, as they say, in September of 1959. 8 years later, he was sentenced to 2 months probation for indecently assaulting a young girl. It didn't take too long before he was again found guilty of indecently assaulting minors, and his license was revoked. He went back to prison to complete his life sentence, and he nearly did. He was released from prison in 1978 and died from heart failure on July the 7th of 1979. I don't think anybody missed him.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. Here, in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide. A warehouse where everyday objects, a tallow candle, for example, a mounted cat, an andiron, all are touched by murder. A bedsheet. It's a familiar object. See them every night, except on rare occasions when you're roughing it. Linen is the usual material. Sometimes they're made of silk. This one is linen. It bears the imprint of the steamship Bengal Tower.
May I make up your bed, Miss Parsons?
Oh, certainly, stewardess. We're on our way, aren't we?
Yes, miss. That's the last we'll see of Cape Town. I'll just change your sheets, miss.
Thank you.
Fresh ones for the first night out.
Today, that bedsheet can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum.
Here we are, the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's very special, very particular museum of murder. If you're a student of criminology, a student with some imagination, I don't think you'll be alone here in the Black Museum. Each small card meant solely to identify crime and criminal will bring to life for you a sinister ghost. You'll walk here, attended simultaneously by killer and killed. Here's a long-necked chemist's flask. It was meant to hold life-giving medicine, but somebody intervened. There was acid in this flask. A few pellets dropped in, dissolved. The flask was smoky with lethal vapor. Sleeping man died. Here's a bicycle, made for fun, but notice the wheels, the crumpled spokes, crushed tires. A girl rode this bike downhill, and a wire was stretched across the roadway. Here we are, the sheet. A common, everyday bed sheet stamped in one corner, SS Bengal Tower. That's a luxury liner on the route between Cape Town and Southampton. It's a nice ship, and a voyage to enjoy, particularly when you're young and homeward bound. Natalie Parsons was young and homeward bound, and very lovely. The first night out, there were two gentlemen friends to dance attendance.
Thank you, Miss Parsons. You make even a lieutenant's life a pleasure.
Why, Lieutenant, I thought the Navy was the life for a young man with adventure in his soul.
Well, that's just the legend, but all legends come to an end. Just like the dancing tonight.
Mr. Morrow, holding the fort at our table all alone. Let's be nice to him, Lieutenant. Mm? I hear he knows the captain of our ship.
The dancing was over in the main salon. The orchestra retired for the night. High above the brilliantly illuminated decks on the dim, binnacle-lighted bridge, Captain Booth had his own thoughts as he paced away his watch.
Ought to be all right. Full passenger list. Decent crew. Engines in good shape. Ship all squared away, topside and below. You never know. That's the worry and the fascination of it. You never know.
No, Captain. You never know, do you? You never know. But such thoughts are ridiculous. Look at the three people at that table near the bar in the first-class lounge this minute. The Parsons girl. Actress, the passenger list says. A naval lieutenant. What was his name? Jeff Hennessy, that's it. And Noel Morrow. Past middle-aged, but quite distinguished. Heavy stockholder in the line which owns your Bengal Tower. Nice people having a fine time.
And this, gentleman, concludes our performance for this evening.
Oh, but it's early yet, Miss Parsons.
Well, I'm not used to the sea air, Lieutenant. I'm tired, so I'm going to bed. And thank you both for a lovely first night at sea.
May I see you to your cabin?
Hold on, I claim that privilege. You dance with her all evening, son. Now it's my turn.
Oh, don't fight, gentlemen. Well, not the first night out, anyway. I think we'll accede to Noel's wish tonight, Jeff. He has some basis to his claim, you know.
There you are, young fellow.
Well, I surrender. There's plenty of time in Southampton, and lots of moonlight.
Yes, plenty of time for fun and enjoyment and even playing at love as the great ship knifes through the tropic seas northward, homeward bound. So Noel Morrow walks Natalie Parsons to her cabin and returns to the bar for a nightcap with Lieutenant Jeff Hennessy.
To Natalie, a nice girl.
I'll drink to that. A fine talent, I hear.
Yes, I saw in a play in Johannesburg, Three-Cornered Moon. Huh? Very amusing.
That's so. Well, I never heard of it. Still, I'm glad I heard of Natalie Parsons. Nice girl.
Good-looking, too.
Yes, all of that and more. Well, here's to a pleasant voyage.
Two gentlemen converse over whiskey and soda, then repair to their respective quarters and fall asleep. 2 a.m. Four bells. on the bridge, the watch is changing.
First officer reporting we're leaving, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Forsyth. We're making 15 knots, course 348, all quite below.
Thank you, sir. I took the liberty of checking before I came topside. The watchmen are reading their station, sir. Stewards and stewardesses turn in, sir.
Very well, mister. Take over. Carry on.
North-northeast, roughly, is the course. The ship moves on. The captain goes to his cabin. First officer Forsyth and the quartermaster stand to on the bridge. All quiet. Below on B deck, the watchman makes his rounds.
That's a funny one. B-24 ringing for steward and stewardess both. We'll have a look.
What is it, man?
Is something wrong, sir?
Nothing's wrong, why?
Both your buzzers are ringing, sir. For your steward and stewardess both.
There must be a mistake. Everything here is fine.
The watchman is puzzled. He goes back. The buzzers have stopped. He checks the cabin list. B-24. Miss Natalie Parsons. He hesitates back to the cabin or up to the bridge. Was it a mistake? He chose the bridge.
What is it, Peter?
B-24 is a ladies' cabin. A single occupied, Mr. Forsyth.
Is it now?
Buzzers was ringing. I answered. A man came to the door. All I did see of him was his trouser leg and shoe. Black, both of them.
Well, strange things can happen on shipboard on a cruise like this, you know. You just go on with your rounds and fill out your report when you go off watch.
Yes, sir. Very well, sir.
In a few moments, I'll go below and check. Want to make sure, meet me at B-24 at 5 bells.
Aye, sir. Thank you, sir.
Strange things do happen on shipboard. Even without tropic seas and a voyage home, quite strange things. 5 bells. 2:30. First officer Forsyth, with watchman Petrie at his elbow, knocked discreetly on the door to B-24.
Unlocked, is it? Careless.
So it seems, sir.
Swing your torch in here, Petrie.
Aye, sir.
Nobody here. Cabin's empty. All right, Petrie. Make your report. I'll enter this on the log. We'll let it go at that. Girls will be girls, Petrie. Trust you haven't forgotten, eh?
Discreet fellow, that first officer, but then he'd had plenty of cruise experience. He noted the matter in the log. After all, he had left the bridge for a few moments. And that was all. Now, it happens that one of the duties of the first officer is to call the roll at boat drill. You know how that goes. The bells clang all over the ship. The passengers joke as they reach for life bells, dusty with disuse, and scramble to the boat deck at the stations noted on their cabin doors. And after a bit, the first officer comes around and checks the roll.
Yes, I know. I quite agree. Yeah. Answer to your names, please, ladies and gentlemen. This is a boat station for cabins B-18 to B-45. All passengers and crew assigned here will answer. Mr. Ainswell?
Here.
Alan Birch?
Here, sir.
Miss Lawrence?
Here.
Mr. Leary?
Present.
Nancy Meadows?
Yes, sir.
Major Morton?
Here.
Miss Parsons? Miss Parsons? Miss Parsons?
The first officer reported to Captain Booth. Captain Booth thought it might be courteous if Miss Parsons were under the weather to pay her a courtesy call. Captain knocked.
Empty.
Strange. Stewardess? Stewardess!
Yes, sir? You wanted me, Captain?
I do. You seen Miss Parsons this morning?
No, sir, I haven't. It's a little queer, rather.
How so?
Well, she wasn't at boat drill either, sir. Her night things are missing.
You laid them out last night, did you?
Yes, sir. Pretty things, too. Just right for her. But not a sign of them this morning, and stains all over the sheet.
How's that? Where?
Here, sir. Sort of red and a few black ones, sir. Streaks, like.
I see. Yeah. Just a moment. There are times when I'm glad first-class cabins have telephones. This is the captain speaking. I want Dr. Stout in B-24 at once. Thank you.
You don't think something's happened, do you, sir? She's such a nice girl.
That's what everyone says. Funny goings-on in here last night. Watchman's report? A log? Notice anything else peculiar here this morning, stewardess?
Well, yes, sir. When the first I came in to straighten up, first off, I noticed the porthole, sir. Swinging open it was, all by itself. I fastened it before anything, sir.
Yes, that's right.
You called for me, Captain?
Yes, Doctor. Take a look at the stains on that sheet, will you?
Right.
All right, stewardess, you can go, but stay on call.
Yes, sir, I'll be right outside.
And send in the watchman.
Yes, sir.
Well, doctor?
These are probably lipstick. The other red spots, they look like blood, I'm afraid. I'll tell better after I've run a test. The black marks beat me.
Not a very pleasant prospect. Blood on the sheet and an open porthole.
Watchman Petrie, Captain.
Ah, yes, don't go, Doctor. Now, see here, Petrie. This man you reported speaking to last night, did you see his face?
Sorry, sir, I didn't. Only his trouser and one shoe, like I told Mr. Forsyth.
I see. It's too bad. What about his voice?
It was muffled, sir, by the door. But he did have, well, a kind of accent, sir.
What kind? American? Welsh? Scots? Irish?
If anything, it was Scotch, sir.
All right. Dismissed.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Doctor,
I don't like the looks of it. I'd seal this cabin and notify owners if I were you.
I'll do that and more. This is the captain. Hey, give me the bridge. Watch, officer, please. Hello, Mr. Matson. Captain Booth here. I want a complete search of the ship at once for a passenger. Natalie Parsons. Crow's nest to block hole. And put the ship about, mister. We're going back on a sea search as well. Calculate our position at 4 bells this morning. I'll be topside directly. We're not going to find her alive, you know, Doctor. But we've got to have a look.
I know.
If this girl went through that porthole alive, the sharks have got her by now. If she went through dead, we have a murderer aboard. As I said before, not a very pleasant prospect, Doctor.
It all didn't look so pleasant. An empty cabin. An open porthole. And blood on the sheet. And I'd remind you that that sheet today can be seen in the Black Museum.
Will you gentlemen have anything to add? Have you, gentlemen?
Neither of them did. But in Southampton, the Criminal Investigation Department did have a few items to add.
All right, Hobson, what's the report on this Parsons girl?
Well, exactly what she said she was, Inspector. Actress.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently quite well accepted in Joburg. Plenty of men at the stage door, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Age 25. Never a touch of scandal. 2 points.
Yes.
She was in the Army Intelligence during the war. Had languages. Good actress. Quite a help.
Oh, possibly in Secret Service nowadays.
No, I called the special branch on that. Positively no. She's back in civil life completely.
Oh, well, that's a possible theory down the drain.
Yes, sir.
Well, you had 2 points, Sergeant.
Yes, sir. The other is, she said she left Joburg for a theatre job here. Well, there's no sign of it, sir. No manager in England has signed her, though some of them knew the name.
Oh, well, keep after that. Oh, how about the passenger and crew list? Anyone familiar?
No, not a criminal record in the lot. And we've checked all 368 of them.
All right, Sergeant. Well, keep after that theatre job angle. Meanwhile, alert the technicians and the harbour police. We'll be going aboard that ship before the pilot takes her over.
A ship with a sealed cabin drew nearer to home. Somehow the festive quality of a voyage home was missing. Tension settled over the Bengal Tower from the bridge to the boiler room. At long, long last, the anchor dropped into Southampton water. The passengers gathered to watch for the pilot boat.
That's no pilot boat, is it, Halsey?
Ah, police launch.
I expected as much.
Funny. You dance with a girl, you know her for 8, 10 hours out of your life. She stays with you.
It happened, son. She was a lovely thing. Don't fall in love with a ghost. You wind up rather lonely, you know.
Thanks. I remember that. Ah, quite a few of them coming aboard.
Yes, we're in for a going over, apparently.
The captain spoke to the passengers and crew of the public address system.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, representatives of the Southampton police have come aboard to proceed with the necessary inquiry into the tragic disappearance of one of our fellow passengers. Until this inquiry has run its course, it'll be necessary to lie off and not to proceed ashore. Your cooperation will be greatly appreciated, and I'm sure you realize that all which can be done is being done to place you ashore as soon as possible. Thank you.
I wish them luck. How I wish them luck.
On B-deck, Inspector Rice took over from a greatly relieved Captain Booth. No time was wasted.
Set up a lab in the ship's pharmacy. Get at those stains. Compare them with the girl's lipstick and get the blood type. And find out what's in those black markings.
Yes, sir.
Now strip the bed and go through her things top to bottom. Now, I want to talk to the watchman, the stewardess. And from what you say, Captain, the man in here that night had a Scots accent.
That's correct.
Well, how many Scotsmen aboard? Have you checked that?
We have. 26, Inspector. 18 passengers, 8 in the crew.
Oh, very good, sir. You have been thorough. Now, you, I take it, are the watchmen.
They work quickly, but they work thoroughly. The watchman and the stewardesses reasserted their statements to the captain with one addition.
Oh, yes, sir. I cleaned the cabin thoroughly. Wiped everything.
That was too bad. No chance now for fingerprints. In the improvised laboratory in the ship's pharmacy, they did better.
Well, the lipstick stains match the lipstick in her luggage exactly, sir.
The blood type on that spotted sheet?
Type O, sir. The girl's army record gives the same type.
Meanwhile, information arrived from ashore.
She had a job waiting for her, Inspector, at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, sir.
And then the police chemist came up with a long-awaited answer.
The black streaks on the sheet, sir. Lamp black wax and petroleum oil. That's shoe polish. But there's a trace of silver polish mixed in, sir.
Ah, now we've got something, Hobson.
Yes, sir, but what?
Well, who'd get silver polish on his boots aboard ship, Sergeant?
Well, it's a weird combination, sir.
A ship steward, Hobson. A steward with a Scots accent. Now, let's see the captain, shall we?
I'll cooperate in any way I can, Inspector. But even if it is one of my men, there's not a thing to tie any of them to the incident.
Well, sir, I have an idea. We can let the passengers ashore now, but hold the crew. Then you invite the police detail and the ship's officers to luncheon. Set up 4 tables well apart, waited on by the 4 stewards you say are Scots-born. At the end of the meal... Thank you, steward. I will have some more coffee. Now, as I was saying, gentlemen, it's practically over. That one fingerprint on the glass of the porthole will hang the man. No question about it. They always forget something, make at least one silly mistake. There'll be a ship's mechanic from our harbor police aboard.
All right, young fella. You can stop polishing that porthole cover now.
What's the meaning of this? I'm doing my job.
There's no fingerprint on the glass. You fell for the inspector's plan. I'll have to take you in charge. Willful murder on suspicion. And I must warn you, anything you say may be taken down in writing.
They smoked him out all right, but he refused to give in without a struggle. It was interesting to watch his mind work as they questioned him.
You're Alan Birch.
I am.
Your first trip aboard the Bengal Tower?
Round trip. Went out in her. This is the return.
Like the ladies, do you?
They seem to like me.
Ever had any trouble with one before?
No, never. What do you mean, before?
Your forearms, Birch, and your neck, all scratched.
No dame ever scratched me.
Well, where did you get them, then?
Ship's cat. I tried to pet her. She let me have it.
It won't wash, Birch. No cat's claws ever scratched like that. Ship's doctor will certify to that. And those scratches aren't old enough to have happened ashore.
All right, then. It was a woman.
Huh?
A stewardess.
Which one?
I'm not saying. She'd lose her job.
Nonsense. Who are you protecting, Birch?
Nobody.
Stop it, Birch. You're only making it harder for yourself. You were on duty for that cabin, among others. She rang. From the watchman's story, the buzzer was stuck. But you didn't realize it until he knocked on the door and spoke to you. You went to B-24, forced your way in, attacked the girl, and when she resisted, you killed her and pushed her through that porthole. Wasn't that the way it was, Birch?
I'll never attack nobody.
We say you did. There's blood on the sheet. Her blood. We'll find it on your clothes, too.
I never attacked her. We had a date. After she ditched the 2 jokers she was dancing and drinking with.
Be careful what you say, Birch. It's all being taken down and may be used in evidence.
I'm telling the truth. I didn't kill her. I was waiting in the cabin like she said. When she came in, she changed her mind or something. She tried to push me out. I don't take that from no woman. I grabbed her. She fell against me. She was foaming at the mouth in a sort of fit. She collapsed. I put her on the bed, tried to give her artificial respiration. That's how the black got on the sheet, maybe.
Probably. Go on, Bert.
When that fool Petrie came to the door, I lost my head. She looked dead. I didn't know what. I locked the door. I couldn't find no heartbeat. Nothing. I figured Petrie would report to the bridge. I picked her up and pushed her out of the porthole.
Why did you decide to tell this tale, Bert?
Because you'd pin it on me anyway. I know coppers. So better than have yous cook it up, you got it my way. I didn't kill nobody here. I didn't kill nobody.
Stanley Birch had told his story. Not a very good story. For there in contradiction was the testimony and evidence, including that blood-stained bedsheet, which you can see today in the Black Museum. Stuart Birch was a ladies' man. There was no doubt about that after the evidence was in. The jury had little doubt either. They convicted Mr. Birch of first-degree murder, despite his protestations, and despite the fact that for the first time in 200 years, a jury had been given a homicide case without a corpus delicti. This was a major aspect of the case, a very interesting one, I think. And further, just after the conviction, the House of Commons suspended the death penalty in England. As for Stuart Birch, you'll find him spending the rest of his natural life in Dartmoor Prison. And as for the spotted bedsheet, it remains in its customary place. In Scotland Yard, in the Black Museum. And now, until we meet next time, the same place, I tell you another story about the Black Museum. I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Strange Adventure.
This is really a story of strange adventure. The stagecoach rumbled to a stop in front of the single hotel of the little desert town, and its only passenger, loaded down with books, climbed down to the dust-laden street. He carefully brushed his loud checkered suit and stepped into the hotel. He walked over to the desk.
Hello. Hello, Sean. How are you? Fine. I'd like some information, if you please.
Why, sure, young fellow. What is it?
Could you tell me who's the most prominent citizen of this fair village?
Well, I guess Les Morton would be the one to fill your bill. He's about the biggest banker and rancher we've got in these parts. His office is right next to the feed store there.
Oh, I see. Thank you. Where does this gentleman live?
Well, in the big house on the second corner down the street.
Later, when Mrs. Morton opened the door and saw our hero and his books, she started to close it again. But it had taken brains to earn the money for that checkered suit, and our hero used them now.
I beg your pardon, ma'am. I didn't come to sell your book. I came to deliver one. Your husband, Mr. Morton, told me to bring this book here, and he would pay me $5.
So she took the book and paid the salesman the $5. A short while later, he was in an office. Les Morton's. This time, there was a slightly different story. The banker was informed that his wife had ordered a book of recipes to be delivered and collected for at the office. Well, Mr. Morton had learned not to argue with his wife. He paid. The young man, $10 richer, walked out of the office and climbed aboard the departing stage. Morton, sitting in his office, got more angry by the minute. His wife should have paid for the book herself. So he took the book, put on his hat, and set out for home. And after talking with his wife, Mr. Morton was really mad. He rushed out of his house and gazed down the street. Far in the distance, he could see the dust rising from the stagecoach. Bill Williams, his friend, had just ridden up.
Bill, right after that stage. Stop it until I can see that book agent aboard it.
Bill wheeled his horse and set off at a hard gallop. A short time later, he pulled up beside the stage.
Hey, pull up, driver. Mr. Morton wants you should wait until he can see that book agent aboard there.
The puzzled driver seesawed on the reins and brought the stage to a halt. The book agent leaned out the window and called the rider alongside.
My good fellow, who did you say wanted to see me?
Les Morton, mister.
Oh, yes, I forgot to give him this book. That'll be $5. Mr. Morton will reimburse you.
The rancher dug down and handed over $5. The stagecoach was off again. Good salesmanship? Well, what do you think? This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon. I gotta tell you, I think Peter Lorre was born to do radio. I mean, he just saunters in and begins to chew up the scenery like he does in this, his summer replacement show for the Abbott and Costello Show. Sponsored by Camel Cigarettes, this show ran between 1945 and 1947. And although Lorre does not star in every episode of the series, the show benefits immensely from his presence. There's another familiar voice on this show, and that's announcer Harry Morgan. Yeah, it's that Harry Morgan. We all tend to think of him as a TV actor. For you youngins, he played Colonel Potter on the TV version of MASH. But like most early TV actors, he had deep roots in radio. I guess the worst thing about this show is that there are only eight of them that survive, those from the 1947 series, and I've played five of them. The episode today, from August the 32nd of 1947, is an adaptation of... I'm going to have trouble with this. I always have trouble with this, so forgive me. Guy de Maupassant's short story, The Hola. Written in 1887, it's a story about a man's descent into madness. As it happens, this story was published shortly before the author's institutionalization in 1891 for syphilitic mental illness. So The Hola is inevitably connected to his own mental illness. In his life, Guy de Maupassant wrote over 300 short stories and 6 novels, and then died at the age of 42 in 1893 in a mental hospital. The Hola is one of those really and truly classic stories that practically everybody has to read in high school, and that nearly everyone who has read of it is impressed by. De Maupassant is regarded, along with Anton Chekhov, as the father of the modern short story. This particular story has been adapted for radio and television several times. It's a story about an invisible creature that lives on water and milk. The Hola seems to the protagonist to be a scout for an invasion from deep space. The story has often been cited as an inspiration for Lovecraft's The Call of Cthulhu. Pretty sure that's right. Which also features an extraterrestrial being who influences mind and is destined to conquer humanity. I'm almost tempted to say that Lorre is actually over the top in this one. But even if he is, it is just fun to listen to him. Let's give it a listen.
Mystery in the Air, starring Peter Lorre, presented by Camel Cigarettes.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are two kinds of stories. Those you can take to bed with you and they relax you and put your mind at ease. And then... then there's the other kind. And our story tonight is the other kind. I still do not know whether it was the shadow of the madness to which the author himself so tragically succumbed, or whether there really was an evil something that could not be seen or described. Oh, why don't you decide for yourself? I'm simply going to tell you the facts in a case as set forth by Guy de Maupassant in his immortal story, The Horla.
Each week at this hour, Peter Lorre brings us the excitement of the great stories of the strange and unusual, of dark and compelling masterpieces culled from the four corners of world literature. Tonight, The Horla by de Maupassant.
Mystery in the Air, starring Peter Lorre, brought to you by Camel Cigarettes.
Oh, what a lovely day it was. I spent all the morning lying in the grass in front of my house, the house in which I was born and grew up. Oh, it's a wonderful house, and I love it. From my windows, I can see our great river, the Seine, which flows along the side of my garden, yes. The great, wide Seine, which goes to Rouen and Le Havre and is covered by boats passing to and fro. Yes, down to the left lies Rouen, and a whole city dominated by the spire of the cathedral and full of bells which sound through the air on fine days, even as far as my home. Oh, what a wonderful morning. I was almost sorry when Marie, she's my housemaid, you know, when she interrupted me.
Your luncheon is ready, monsieur.
Oh, thank you, Marie, but, you know, it seems a pity to go in a house. Say, do you like it here, Marie?
Oh, yes, sir. I like it very much. Yeah. I love to watch the boats go by on the Seine.
Well, you do, huh? So do I. See that one? That big schooner, and it's being pulled by... Look, what a little tug. Oh, look, it's no bigger than a fly.
Isn't it beautiful? So clean and white, shining.
All white, yes, and she's a three-master, you know. Brazilian, I think, yes. Yes, I can see the flag. It is Brazilian. Oh, she's had a long journey from South America to pass my house.
You love this place very much, don't you, monsieur?
Yes, Marie, I love it. I can feel those deep roots which attach a man to the soil on which his ancestors were born and died and to the villages, yes, to the atmosphere itself. You don't know what I'm talking about, do you, Marie?
No, sir.
No.
But I do know that if you don't come into the house soon, your luncheon will be cold.
All right, Marie, I'll come in. For some reason, I've had a slight feverish attack the last few days, and I feel low-spirited and ill. I have continually a horrible feeling of impending danger, an apprehension of some coming misfortune or of approaching death. I've never experienced anything like this before. If it continues, I think I'll have to see my doctor.
Look, I've told you, your pulse is rapid and your eyes are slightly dilated. Otherwise, you're in splendid condition.
But, Doctor, then why is it when evening comes on, a feeling of oppression seizes me, just as if night concealed something horrible? Why is that?
Probably just a slight attack of indigestion.
Yes, yes, indigestion. Yesterday, when I was walking in a forest of Rumor, why did it suddenly seem to me that I was being followed and that someone was walking at my heels close, quite close to me? He was near enough to touch me, and yet when I turned around, I saw nothing. Nothing behind me but the path between the tall trees. Horribly empty. Can you explain that by indigestion, can you, huh?
Well, here's a bromide. Hmm. If you'll take it in several cold showers daily, I'm sure your fears will vanish.
Yes, I'm and sure.
And you'll be able to sleep without any further trouble.
All right, Doctor. Thank you very much. Who is there?
It's I, Marie.
Just a moment. Yes?
Are you all right?
What
You're
is it,
screaming
Marie?
And calling out.
I'm sorry.
Wake the servants.
I must have been here having a nightmare, Marie. Look,
how
if you dreamed that someone was looking at you and touching you and taking your neck in his hands and squeezing it, squeezing with all his might in order to strangle you, don't you think you would cry out too, huh? Oh.
Yes, sir, I'm sure
well,
I should.
You see, all right. Just tell the other servants I shall try to be more quiet.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Good night.
Hey, look. Look, Marie. My water carafe.
Your water carafe, monsieur?
Yes, it was full. I know it was full when I went to bed.
Yes, sir, I filled it last night.
Yes, and now it's empty. I haven't touched it, and it's empty.
Yes, sir.
Somebody has drunk the water. Somebody has... Has been in his room. Somebody, something, drank that water.
I don't know who could have, sir, unless perhaps you yourself in your sleep.
Yes, yes, I myself in my sleep, of course, that's it. I must have done it myself, Marie. Marie, tell him to pack my things. I'm going to Paris. I'm leaving the first thing in the morning. July 12th. Paris. Paris, I must have lost my head during the last few weeks. At home, my mental state bordered on madness, for I had believed... Yes, I had believed that an invisible being lived beneath my roof. How stupid, how perfectly ridiculous it all seems now, yes. 24 hours in Paris have completely restored my equilibrium, and tonight I'm going to dine at the house of my cousin, Madame Sablé, and, oh, Dr. Parent is going to be there. He's the famous specialist for nervous disorders, and I shall ask him, and I'm sure he can finally put my mind at rest about this silly hallucination. But, Dr. Parent, I've been wanting to ask you, have you ever known of a case where a person feels that he is, how shall I put it, not entirely in command of his soul?
It is curious that you should ask me that.
Why is it curious?
Because now, only now in 1889,
yes.
After all these years, we are on the verge of discovering one of the most important secrets of nature.
What is that?
Ever since man has thought, he has felt himself close to a mystery which has been impenetrable to his gross and imperfect senses.
Yes.
Whatever are you talking about, Dr. Parent?
Apparitions, my dear Madame Sablé. Invisible spirits.
Oh, you doctors. You're always being mysterious.
Oh, not at all. For more than a century now, men seem to have had a presentiment of something new.
Yes.
Mesmer and some others have put us on an unexpected track, and we have arrived at really surprising results.
Oh, you're just trying to frighten us.
Not at all. If you think so, would you like me to try to send you to sleep, madame?
It would be a novel experience. If you can do it.
And if I can, it will answer your cousin's questions.
Yes, it certainly will.
And now, madame, if you will just sit in this easy chair. So. Now, you must let your mind go completely blank and look fixedly into my eyes. Yes, that's right. Now, you are going to sleep. To sleep. You're going to sleep. 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 You see, her eyes are becoming heavy. Her mouth is twitching.
That's incredible.
Sleep. You have nothing but
Doctor,
sleep
I don't like this.
Mind.
It frightens me.
Sleep. Sleep. Here, now she is asleep. An easy subject, I must say. Now, if you will stand directly behind her chair, I will proceed with the experiment. Now, I hand her an ordinary pasteboard visiting card, so. Now, Madame Sablé, you hold in your hand a looking glass.
Yes. I am holding a looking glass.
What do you see in it?
I see my cousin standing behind my chair.
Daphne, what is he doing?
He is twisting his ear.
But, Doctor, she cannot see me behind her by looking at a piece of cardboard.
No, of course she can't. She sees you through her mind. Or someone's mind. This troubles you, doesn't it?
Yes, it troubles me.
But it answers your question.
No. No, it does not. That's common knowledge, Doctor. It's an axiom that human beings can be dominated by human beings, but what if a human being is dominated by something, by something else, I mean, something not human? What then, Doctor? August 6th. I'm back at home. Yes, now I know it's useless to struggle. Useless. Somebody possesses my soul and dominates it. Somebody orders all my acts, all my thoughts. I'm nothing except his slave and a terrified spectator of all I do. Yes, but who is he, this invisible being that rules me, this unknowable spirit, this rover of a supernatural race, he must have a name. I know he has. I feel it. I can feel it. And, oh, someday it will come to me. Oh, if I only could leave my house and go away and escape and never return. But it's impossible. This being I cannot call by name, he will not let me. I'm helpless. What can I do? What can I do?
Back to de Maupassant's terrifying story of a man obsessed by the idea that he is dominated by an invisible being. Fear is ruining his life. The suspicion that he is no longer master of his own actions, even of his own soul, is rapidly becoming a certainty.
It's only 2:00, and the whole night is before me. Oh, how still it is. And the stars. How bright they are. Who inhabits those faraway regions, and what do they know that we do not know? Will not one of them someday appear on our earth to conquer it? We are so weak, so defenseless. And what was that? I heard the rustle of paper. Yet there's no wind. Absolutely no wind. There. It's that book, yes. The one on the table under the lamp. It's incredible. The page has turned. The page lifted itself up and fell down upon the others as if a finger had turned it over. My armchair appears empty, but no, it isn't. No, he's there. I know he is, sitting in my place. He's reading. I can't stand it any longer. I'll grasp him and... He ran away. He ran away before I could reach him. He ran away and the window closed after him. He's afraid of me.
He's afraid of me. What do you call yourself, you evil slave? Whatever it is, someday I'll catch you and crush you.
Here, come in here.
What? What?
We heard the noise and we wondered. Another nightmare, monsieur.
No, it's not a nightmare. I was awake. Tell me, Marie, do you believe in invisible things?
Invisible?
Yes, invisible beings that dominate you.
Well, I read an article about that in the paper today.
What did it say?
That somewhere in Brazil, I think, people are frightened, leaving their houses, saying they're pursued by invisible beings which feed on their life while they're asleep.
Yeah.
Like vampires, you know?
Marie, that is where he came from.
Oh, monsieur.
Don't you remember the day we saw that little tug pulling that big Brazilian schooner up the river?
Yes.
Remember, she looked so white, all white, and he was on board. Yes, he came from there where his race originated, and he saw me, and he saw my white house, and he sprang from the ship. Oh, now I understand. Don't you? Don't you?
No, monsieur, I don't.
No, you couldn't. It's all right, Marie, go to bed. There's nothing wrong. Don't worry anymore. Go back to sleep. Go. Yes, now I know. How can I help but knowing? It's obvious. Yes, the rule of man is over, and he has come. He has arrived. But what is his name? What do you call yourself? What's that? I know it. He's shouting it out. Yes, I listen. Huh? Orla. That's it, yes. The Horla. Yes, the Horla. He haunts me. He is within me. He's becoming my soul. I shall kill him.
There, monsieur.
What?
The iron shutters on the windows and door complete.
All right.
Know why anybody wants half-inch iron shutters in their bedroom is more than I can see. Well, at least it'll keep everything
out. I don't want to keep things out. I want to keep something in.
Hmm?
Never mind. If you're finished, you take your tools and go. My housekeeper will pay you.
Yes, monsieur. Good day, monsieur.
Good day. Now I'm ready. Yes, tonight he'll come. But tonight I'm ready for him. I'm ready for him. He's here, yes. I feel it. At last he's here, but I don't want to alarm him. I'll casually close the iron shutter so casually as if I'm preparing for bed. And now I'll start to close the iron doors as if I'm shutting myself in for the night. But instead of shutting myself in, I'll shut myself out. Yes, it's down. He's inside. He cannot escape. Downstairs, yes. As fast as I can run. Oh, good. The lamp is still burning. Yes, fire. Fire, that'll dispose of him. Fire. Oh, see, the house is dry as tinder. Won't take long. See, the flames are reaching the ceiling already. I'd better get out before I burn myself up, too. Here, I can watch from here. How slow the house is burning. Don't you suppose? No, there, yes. A tongue of flame licking out on the top of the window. And another, and another. see it burn. My house, my beautiful house. And, oh, but it's more beautiful. It's now in flames because he's inside. And he'll burn too, yes, and I'll be free. Free of the horror.
Fire! 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 The house is on fire! Yes. Get some water, somebody!
Yes, it's burning. Ready, burning. Oh, now the whole place is in flames. Nothing can stop it.
That's Marie, the servants in the garret. They'll be killed. Stand back, all of you. The roof's going to cave in.
Look.
Oh, the poor devils. We've got to get some help.
Yes.
Get them out of there.
It's lighting up the whole countryside. A monstrous, beautiful fuel pyre. And he's burning, too. My prisoner, that new being, that new master, the horror. The roof has fallen in. The roof has fallen in.
Over. That is the end for him. He's dead. Yes, but is he dead? No. A spirit would never fear premature destruction. Only we fear it. All our human terror springs from that, and well, then after man, what? The horror, yes. After us, who can die any day by any accident, comes he who can die only at his own proper hour, because he has touched the limits of his existence. No, he's not dead. Well, what can I do? What can I do? Oh, there's one thing I can do. I can destroy myself. Yes. I must destroy myself. I'm going to destroy myself. Destroy. Yes. Let me go. Yes. I know I'm Peter Lorre. I know it's a story. I know it's by de Maupassant. Yes. I know it's Thursday night and we are on the air, but... I beg your pardon. I'm sorry I got so excited, but I warned you at the beginning. It's a very uncomfortable story.
Mystery in the Air, starring Mr. Peter Lorre, brings you Beyond Good and Evil by Ben Hecht, with a special musical score composed and conducted by Paul Barron. Listen again next week at this same time when the makers of Camel Cigarettes present Mr. Peter Lorre in Mystery in the Air. Next week's play will be Beyond Good and Evil by Ben Hecht. The artists supporting Mr. Lorre tonight were Henry Morgan as the voice of Mystery, Peggy Weber as Marie, Lorene Tuttle as Madame Sablé, Ken Christie as the Doctor, Ben Wright as Dr. Parent, Howard Culver and Jack Edwards Jr. This is Michael Roy in Hollywood wishing you a pleasant good night for Camel.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company. Ellery Queen.
Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Curious Gangland Killing. When a small-time gangster named Lopez was found dead at the bottom of the river, police immediately assumed it was a gangland killing. Lopez was found tied tightly with cotton rope. His legs were bound together with heavy irons. Open and shut case, said the police. But I investigated and found out Lopez had a lot of insurance, and he was suffering from an incurable disease. This wasn't a gangland killing, I insisted, but a case of suicide. The police didn't believe me till I showed them why. In a moment, I'll explain. In the case of the Curious Gangland Killing, you recall Lopez was tied tightly with cotton rope. Actually, he tied himself up loosely and the cotton rope tightened in the water. By appearing to have been killed, his wife would collect double indemnity, and she almost did. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Well, what we got next is an episode of SF-68, which was a South African radio series that featured some very high-caliber adaptations of short stories. Unfortunately, this was a short-lived series from, appropriately enough, 1968. It was produced and directed by the dean of radio drama in that country, one Michael McCabe, who, in every case I can think of, also did the adaptations of the stories.
They give you a chance.
And starred in most of them, too. But he was kind of a one-man, well, you know, he was kind of an Orson Welles of South Africa. Who, by the way, also often worked in Britain. The stories that were adapted by SF-68 were usually from established science fiction writers.
A large quantity of ammunition,
people like Ray Bradbury, Harlan Ellison, Murray Leinster, and a host of others. I have to admit that most of the copies which I've heard are of somewhat inferior sound quality.
I've already told you, Harvey.
This particular one, tonight's pretty good.
Both the American and
in any case,
it's
good enough, I think, to put up a little less than optimum sound quality. Today's episode, Routine Exercises from July the 6th of 1968, and it details the attempts of a captain of an atomic submarine to explain exactly how the ship incurred all of that damage. And why is it now that the captain fired off those torpedoes?
The nuclear submarine Taurus was doing double
all
numbers.
While on a routine mission?
The exercises included the theoretical
launching
of a Hubble missile.
This is from a short story by Philip E. High, which was published in the British science fiction magazine New Worlds for February of 1961.
It was a sort of bump, sir. Bump. Like a distant depth charge. It's sort of hard to describe. What then? I ordered immediate surfacing, sir, and I went up to have a look around.
What's happened, sir? It stinks. You smell it, sir, like a compost heap or rotting vegetables. Or...
Don't make a song and dance about it, Mendel. We're being watched by our American friends, remember?
Landmass 18 miles ahead. How can that be? It's supposed to be 128. But compasses are spinning round like pinwheels, sir. I...
What?
Thought I saw something. Fly across the moon, sir.
Did you? Nothing, Mendel. Probably a flying saucer, that's all.
Sir, it's not supposed to be a full moon.
Hello, Bridge. Captain speaking.
Trice here, sir. We're being blipped. Something like a radar beam is bouncing off our hull every 17 seconds and closing.
Closing?
Getting more frequent, sir, as if they're shortening their arc, trying to center on us.
Very good, Trice. Keep me posted. Get me the entire ship.
Okay, sir. Go ahead.
The captain speaking. Attention, all hands. This is a genuine alert. Repeat, genuine. Circumstances have arisen which may make it necessary for us to take offensive or defensive action at a moment's notice. Under the peculiar circumstances apparent to all, I have no alternative but to place this vessel at full alert. Action stations, load all torpedo tubes, stand by. That is all.
Man battle station torpedo. Man battle station torpedo.
Whoever it is hanging on to us, sir.
Pull ahead together. All right, Trice, stand by.
Vessel, bearing green 05.
See anything?
An outline, sir. No navigation lights.
Signals, challenge.
Guns are ready, sir.
Lights! Search lights! Blast it!
Sir, there... I mean, nothing... No answer.
All guns, fire!
What the devil was it, sir?
I don't know. Candidly, I don't want to know.
Something impossible is happening. I don't know exactly how to explain what I mean, but... Well, you never know with atomic subs, do you, sir? The blown circuit and that queer bump. That thing I saw fly across the moon, sir. And I did see it, sir. And it wasn't a flying saucer. Looked like a... pterodactyl. Flying lizard sort of thing. Does anything fit, sir?
If you're playing around with time shift theories, Mendel, stop it. It doesn't work. Yes, Wallace?
The forward lookout, sir. He's gone. I went to take him some cocoa, sir. The deck was all wet and slippery. All I found left were these. His night glasses, sir. They've been crushed. Like something that weighed a 100 tons hit him.
Radar blips every 3 seconds. 15 fathoms,
Trice. Deepening?
Deepening, sir. Seabed slanting away. Sheer. 22. 23 now, sir. Going down like a cliff.
We'll take a chance it stays that way. All right, Mendel. Clear decks and secure. Stand by to dive. Maximum depth.
Keep them up on the dog.
Cut engines.
Something happened up there, sir?
We were fired on. They straddled us with the first cell there.
Shells, huh?
I wouldn't know. I had the impression it was some form of condensed energy. Maybe I just dreamed that part. There's something above us. Three somethings. And they're hunting us. Traveling in line abreast. Probably making about 15 knots.
Care to buy a fine tooth comb, sir?
Not now, thanks. Our friends up there are giving them away gratis. I think the word hostile is an adequate description, don't you? Up, periscope. Visibility poor. Missed. ahead. Surface parties close up. Torpedo men stand by, Chief. Issue automatic weapons. Pick two reliable men for additional guard duties. Surface.
Inside of a pressure cooker. Phew. Still stinks, doesn't it, sir?
Yes, only worse. Attention all surface parties. All guards, watch the surface of the water. If anything comes up, or if there's any visible disturbance below the surface, don't wait. Open fire immediately.
Depth 580, sir.
Good job.
Join the Navy and see the world. You see that, don't
we? Aircraft at 1 o'clock, Captain. 75,000 feet off, descending in spirals, making about 1,200 knots.
Clear decks. Diving stations. Dive, dive!
Up, periscope. I don't know. Something. Craft. Never seen anything like. About 130 feet long. It's like an elongated pear drop. No ports, no openings. It's sort of, well, spaceship. Only it floats. They're using their tubes as a drive, making about 8 knots.
Looking for us. Looking for us again.
Pinpointing us. This is something they've rigged up on the spur of the moment.
That surface up there. The heat, sir. The land being close when it shouldn't be. You remember I said... Well, you did too, sir. Something about time. The original blowout, sir. I think we've jumped. I think somehow we're back in... I did see something fly across the moon.
Quiet. Stand by for the torpedo tubes.
How much does the thing draw? Better give the torpedoes a surface setting.
Coming across our bow, sir. Dead straight line at green O.
Fire one. Fire two. Dive deeper. Emergency lighting.
We hit whatever it was, sir. Twice. Don't think there'll be much to salvage, do you?
No. No.
Periscope depth. Up, periscope.
Sir? Hardly be any wreckage. After that explosion.
It's nothing. Oily. Terribly thick, the water seems. Doesn't seem like the water of the Atlantic. Dead fish. Dead.
What?
Body.
You saw?
Just floated. Young man. He's human. Somehow I expected anything that came off whatever's been after us not to be human. Pull her head together.
Going to stick to periscope depth, sir?
I prefer to know what's happening. If we lost a ship under similar circumstances, I think we'd go looking for it, don't you? I don't think their reaction will be any different. Let's hope they're too far away when they arrive.
Let's have another look.
Didn't take him long. You'd better take a look, Mandel. It could be a dream, but I have my doubts.
What the devil is it? A baby moon or something?
Looks almost big enough, doesn't it? I think it's the mothership.
I don't understand.
I'll explain later. Missile party, close up.
Think like the enemy. Place yourself in his position. They must be a stellar race. Probably on a survey mission. Probably checking on likely planets for future colonization or something. When their instruments detected us with an obvious technology, their commander must have done a double take. Mendel is right. Somehow, we are in waters that are not the Atlantic of the 1960s. Something's happened to time. We've gone back. The heat, the smell, the land mass where it shouldn't be, adds up to one thing, that we're in another time. Somehow, I don't know how. And this spaceship cannot understand why a technology is functioning in a prehistoric world.
The mothership can't expect us to have anything that can strike from out of the water into the air. That's what the enemy must think. He's got to think that. Missile party, stand by to launch.
I don't expect to win. Making a gesture, that's all. A gesture of self-preservation. Better than running away. Where could we run to? A nice safe port. Someone might build several million years in the future.
Missile party at the ready, sir.
Countdown.
The thing's no more than 5,000 feet above us.
Missile away, sir. Number two, countdown. Two away, sir. Dive. We got her. Got it, sir.
I think we did.
She's breaking up fast, sir. Backing her.
Why is she breaking up so quickly? Our hull was built to keep pressure out. A spaceship, I suppose, would be built to keep pressure in. Her bulkheads and doors, therefore, are failing when water under enormous pressure starts rushing in.
A lot of her machinery is still functioning.
Mendel?
It's Wilkins, sir. I think he's dead. He was just making a routine check of the fuses when the current arced right across his hands. For no reason.
No reason.
Wilkins knew his job, sir. Flash and bang came with the same sort of bump we had in the beginning, sir. Before all the queer business started.
I'll put him in the torpedo room for a minute. I'll be along. Up, periscope.
How is it, sir? How does it look?
Just as it should look, Mendel. The North Atlantic. Grey. Windy. Cold. That's the end.
Yes, we imagined it might be something like that.
You believe me, sir? You're not humoring me.
On the contrary, certain crustacea adhering to the hull of the Taurus no longer exist today, save as fossils. Now, I know you're not a scientist, Harvey, but Have you formed any theory for yourself as to why this time shift took place?
Well, sir, I don't think it was anything to do with Taurus. I think it was something they were doing.
Go on.
I think for a vessel to travel between the stars, it would have to overcome time as well as space. I think they'd have to bend time in relation to space. Otherwise, an interstellar journey would be everlasting. Possibly, conditions were just right. I think they were checking their power units, and somehow they tuned into us. We, in the present, on a routine exercise. They, in the past. Our past. This world's past. The time was... conditions were just right for us, too. The right power coming from our reactors. Unwittingly, they created a time warp, and we were snatched into it.
And then, when the seawater reached those mechanisms, a short was created, and the process reversed itself.
Yes. They, a far-developed civilization, were surveying a prehistoric planet, our planet, Earth, millions of years ago. And we, in the present, highly developed, were snatched back to the past, our own planet's past. Heavens, sir. Think how developed their world must be now.
Captain Harvey, it's only fair to tell you that you've come out of this rather well. For purposes of secrecy, your crew were interrogated under drugs, and all of them praised your bearing. Obviously, we can't give you a medal, but shall we say that promotion from now on will probably be quite rapid?
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
Something still worrying you?
A highly advanced race could sink to barbarism, multiply, and in the course of a few million years, climb up again, couldn't it?
Yes. Yes, I suppose it could. But I fail to see quite what you're driving at.
It was a devil of a size, that thing we shot down, sir. Should have been at least 4,000 or 5,000 souls saved from it. They'd probably have made land somehow.
Well, I'm afraid I still don't.
I shot down the mothership, cut them off from their world forever. They were just like us. I saw a body floating in the water. Just like us. I can't help wondering if we, the people of Earth, are the descendants of the survivors.
You have just been listening to Routine Exercise by Philip E. High. To you by Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder. Routine Exercise was adapted for broadcasting and produced by Michael McCabe. Listen again next Friday night at 9:30 to SF68.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Lawrence. Australian Legendary Tales Folklore by Mrs. K. Langlo Parker. Chapter 11. The Kookaburras and the Goolagool. Googar, the iguana, was married to Modi, the opossum, and Kookaburra, the laughing jackass. Kookaburra was the mother of three sons, one growing up and living away from her, the other two only little boys. They had their camps near a Goolagool, whence they obtained water. A Goolagool is a water-holding tree of the iron bark or box species. It is a tree with a split in the fork of it and hollow below the fork. After heavy rain, this hollow trunk would be full of water, which water would have run into it through the split in the fork. A Goolagool would hold water for a long time. The blacks knew a Goolagool, amongst other trees, by the mark which the overflow of water made down the trunk of the tree, discoloring the bark. One day, Googar, the iguana, and his two wives went out hunting, leaving the two little kookaburras at the camp. They had taken out water for themselves in their opossum-skinned water bags. but they had left none for the children, who were too small to get any from the Gulagul for themselves, so nearly perished from thirst. Their tongues were swollen in their mouths, and they were quite speechless, when they saw a man coming toward them. When he came near, they saw it was Kookaburra, their big brother. They could not speak to him and answer when he asked where his mother was. Then he asked them what was the matter. All they could do was point toward the tree. He looked at it and saw it was a Gulagul. So he said, "Did your mother leave you no water?" They shook their heads. He said, "Then you are perishing for want of a drink, my brothers." They nodded. "Go," he said, "a little way off, and you shall see how I will punish them for leaving my little brothers to perish of thirst." He went toward the tree, climbed up it, and split it right down. As he did so, out gushed the water in a swiftly running stream. Soon the little fellows quenched their thirst, and then, in their joy, bathed in the water, which grew in volume every moment. In the meantime, those who had gone forth to hunt were returning, and as they came toward their camp, they met a running stream of water. "What is this?" they said. "Our Gulagul must have burst." And they tried to dam the water, but it was running too strongly for them. They gave up the effort and hurried on toward their camp, but they found a deep stream divided them from their camp. The three Kookaburras saw them, and the eldest one said to the little fellows, "You call out and tell them to cross down there, where it is not deep." The little ones called out as they were told, and where they pointed, Gura and his wives waded into the stream. Finding she was getting out of her depth, Kookaburra, the laughing jackass, cried out, "Gur, gur, gaga! Gur, gur, gaga! Give me a stick! Give me a stick!" But from the bank, her sons only answered in derision, "Gur, gur, gaga! Gur, gur, gaga!" And the three hunters were soon engulfed in the rushing stream, drawn down by the current and drowned. End of Chapter 11. Recording by David Lawrence in Brampton, Ontario, December 6, 2008.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Police headquarters, Inspector Hoskins speaking.
Police?
Yeah? Yeah, what is it?
Sam Blake speaking, 37 Hudson Way. Come quick, my wife is dead. Gas.
Dead? How long?
I don't know. Just got home.
37 Hudson Way. Okay, be right out. And in the meantime, you better throw open those windows and doors. Hey, Mike, grab your chapeau. We got some calling to do. Mr. Blake?
Yes, Inspector. Come right in.
Thanks. Oh, Mr. Blake, my assistant, Mike Kosky.
Howdy.
Where's the body? You haven't moved her?
No, sir. She's here in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
Right where I found her.
Mm-hmm, of course. Well, Mike and I'll just have a look.
Yeah, there she is, Inspector. Dead as a doornail.
Gassed, all right. You can still smell a little.
Yeah, looks like most of the gas came from the oven. The door's still a little open. What's that?
My simple powers of deduction would say it's a bird.
Oh, there it is, a canary. A bird cage in the kitchen, huh?
Yeah, but right now we better get back to Mr. Blake. Now, Mr. Blake, if you don't mind, there are just a few routine questions. I'd like to know exactly what happened.
Well, sir, I just come home from the game tonight. I'm quite a fan, but my wife didn't care much for sports, so I usually went alone. As I was saying, the game was over about 10:20, I should say.
And you came right home?
Yes, sir. I drove and made it home about 11. I thought I smelled something when I tried the door, and the minute it was open, it hit me in the face. Gas all over the place. I rushed in, calling to Jane, and when I went to turn off the jets, I found her there on the floor, dead.
I see.
Of course, I knew she was gone when I found her. First thing I could think of was to call the police.
Your wife has obviously been dead since about 10. Mr. Blake, if you don't mind my asking, just what happened in the last few seconds of play at the game?
Why, Zankowitz fumbled and Tarleton recovered for an 80-yard touchdown run. Well, look here, Inspector. What are you driving at?
Just that in case this shouldn't be suicide, I wanted to know if you could back up your alibi.
Not suicide? What are you driving at, boss?
Yes, Inspector. What are you driving at?
Just this, Mr. Blake. I arrest you for the murder of your wife.
What did Mr. Blake overlook? Do you know the clue? In a moment, we'll hear firsthand from the inspector. But first...
Ladies and gentlemen, in the next 7 years of bigger and bigger enrollments, America's grade schools will need nearly 250,000 extra teachers besides those to fill normal vacancies. This great need, plus the growing public interest in education and improvements in schools, make elementary school teaching a more rewarding career than ever. A career that high school and college students should certainly consider. Education holds America's future. Perhaps your future.
And now let's see if your powers of deduction are the same as the inspector's.
You can't arrest me. I was at the game till 10:20. I proved it. And you said yourself my wife died 20 minutes before.
I haven't forgotten the powers of radio, Mr. Blake. But there are a few things you did forget. First of all, if you wanted to kill your wife and then make it look like she was overcome by gas, it might have helped if you'd turned on enough gas. Your wife was dead from another cause, the source of which will be found in an autopsy before the gas jet was even opened. The thing you forgot, Mr. Blake, is that canaries are quite as susceptible to gas as human beings. If there had been enough gas in that kitchen to kill a woman, a small bird certainly could not have survived. And your singing canary is still alive, Mr. Blake. Very much alive.
I spent a little bit of time in the company of John Kendrick Banks, who was an American author and satirist. He was born in 1862 and died in 1922, and is credited with creating the kind of fantasy story that takes place wholly, or maybe partially, in the afterlife. Strange to think that somebody wrote one of those stories for the first time. Well, maybe that's not so strange. I mean, clearly, somebody wrote one of those stories for the first time. But it is odd to think that we know who it was. Banks was educated as a lawyer, but actually toiled in the world of magazines, finally being appointed to Pluck magazine in 1903. This particular story, The Quicksilver Cassandra, was published in his book, The Water Ghost of Harrow B. Hall, in 1894. This was a 296-page collection of stories that sold, according to a magazine called Book News, subtitled A Survey of Literature from August of 1894 to September of 1895, and published in Philadelphia in 1895, for 90 cents. Or you could buy it by mail for a dollar and a penny.
A Quicksilver Cassandra by John Kendrick Bangs. Read by John Taylor, Southeast Missouri, September 2006. It was altogether queer, and Jingleberry to this day does not entirely understand it. He had examined his heart as carefully as he knew how, and had arrived at the entirely reasonable conclusion that he was in love. He had every symptom of that malady. When Miss Marion Chapman was within range of his vision, there was room for no one else there. He suffered from that peculiar optical condition which enabled him to see but one thing at a time when she was present, and she was that one thing, which was probably the reason why, in his mind's eye, she was the only woman in the world. for Marion was ever present before Jingleberry's mental optic. He had also examined, as thoroughly as he could in hypothesis, the heart of this only woman, and he had, or thought he had, which amounts to the same thing, reason to believe that she reciprocated his affection. She certainly seemed glad always when he was about. She called him by his first name, and sometimes quarreled with him as she quarreled with no one else. And if that wasn't a sign of love in a woman, then Jingleberry had studied the sex all his years, and they were 32, for nothing. In short, Marion behaved so like a sister to him that Jingleberry, knowing how dreams and women go by contraries, was absolutely sure that a sister was just the reverse from that relationship which in her heart of hearts she was willing to assume towards him, and he was happy in consequence. Believing this, it was not at all strange that he should make up his mind to propose marriage to her. Though, like many other men, he was somewhat chicken-hearted in coming to the point. 4 times had he called upon Marion for the sole purpose of asking her to become his wife, and 4 times had he led up to the point and then talked about something else. What quality is it in a man that makes a coward of him in the presence of one he considers his dearest friend is not within the province of this narrative to determine. But Jingleberry had it in its most virulent form. He had often got so far along in his proposal as, "Marion, will you... And there he had as often stopped, contenting himself with such commonplace conclusions as, "Go to the matinee with me tomorrow," or, "Ask your father for me if he thinks the stock market is likely to strengthen soon," and other amazing substitutes for the words he so ardently desired, yet feared, to utter. But this afternoon, the one upon which the extraordinary events about to be narrated took place, Jingleberry had called, resolved not to be balked in his determination to learn his fate. He had come to propose, and propose he would, ruat coelum. His confidence in a successful termination to his suit had been reinforced that very morning by the receipt of a note from Miss Chapman asking him to dine with her parents and herself that evening, and to accompany them after dinner to the opera. Surely that meant a great deal, and Jingleberry conceived that the time was ripe for a blushing yes to his long-deferred question. So he was here in the Chapman parlor, waiting for the young lady to come down and become the recipient of the interesting interrogatory, as it is called in some sections of Massachusetts. "I'll ask her the first thing," said Jingleberry, buttoning up his Prince Albert, as though to impart a possibly needed stiffening to his backbone. "She will say yes, and then I shall enjoy the dinner and the opera so much the more. Ahem. I wonder if I am pale. I feel sort of... there's a mirror. That will tell." Jingleberry walked to the mirror, an oval, gilt-framed mirror, such as was very much the vogue 50 years ago, for which reason alone, no doubt, it was now admitted to the gold and white parlor of the House of Chapman. "Blessed things, these mirrors," said Jingleberry, gazing at the reflection of his face. "So reassuring. I'm not at all pale. Quite the contrary. I'm red as a sunset. Good omen, that. The sun is setting on my bachelor days, and my scarf is crooked." "Ah!" The ejaculation was one of pleasure, for pictured in the mirror, Jingleberry saw the form of Marianne entering the room through the portières. "How do you do, Marianne? Been admiring myself in the glass," he said, turning to greet her. Here he stopped, as well he might, for he addressed no one. Miss Chapman was nowhere to be seen. "Dear me," said Jingleberry, rubbing his eyes in astonishment. "How extraordinary! I surely thought I saw her. Why, I did see her. That is, I saw her reflection in the glass. Ha, ha! She caught me gazing at myself there, and has hidden." He walked to the door and drew the portiere aside and looked into the hall. There was no one there. He searched every corner of the hall and the dining room at its end, and then returned to the parlor, but it was still empty. And then occurred the most strangely unaccountable event in his life. As he looked about the parlor, he for the second time found himself before the mirror, but the reflection therein, though it was of himself with his back turned to his real self, as he stood gazing amazedly into the glass. And besides this, although Jingleberry was alone in the real parlor, the reflection of the dainty room showed that there he was not so, for seated in her accustomed graceful attitude in the reflected armchair was nothing less than the counterfeit presentment of Marianne Chapman herself. It was a wonder Jingleberry's eyes did not fall out of his head, he stared so. What a situation it was, to be sure, to stand there and see in the glass a scene which, as far as he could observe, had no basis in reality. And how interesting it was for Jingleberry to watch himself going through the form of chatting pleasantly there in the mirror's depths with the woman he loved. It almost made him jealous, though the reflected Jingleberry was so entirely independent of the real Jingleberry. The jealousy soon gave way to consternation, for, to the wondering suitor, the independent reflection was beginning to do that for which he himself had come. In other words, there was a proposal going on, there in the glass, and Jingleberry enjoyed the novel sensation of seeing how he himself would look when passing through a similar ordeal. Altogether, however, it was not as pleasing as most novelties are, for there were distinct signs in the face of the mirrored Marianne that the mirrored Jingleberry's words were distasteful to her, and that the proposition he was making was not one she could entertain under any circumstances. She kept shaking her head, and the more she shook it, the more the glazed Jingleberry seemed to implore her to be his. Finally, Jingleberry saw his quicksilver counterpart fall upon his knees before Marianne of the glass, and hold out his arms and hands toward her in an attitude of prayerful despair, whereupon the girl sprang to her feet, stamped her left foot furiously upon the floor, and pointed the unwelcome lover to the door. Jingleberry was fairly staggered. What could be the meaning of so extraordinary a freak of nature? Surely it must be prophetic. Fate was kind enough to warn him in advance, no doubt, otherwise it was a trick. And why should she stoop to play so paltry a trick as that upon him? Surely fate would not be so petty. No, it was a warning. The mirror had been so affected by some supernatural agency that it divined and reflected that which was to be instead of confining itself to what Jingleberry called simultaneity. It led instead of following or acting coincidentally with the reality, and it was the part of wisdom, he thought, for him to yield to its suggestion and retreat. And as he thought this, he heard a soft, sweet voice behind him. "I hope you haven't got tired of waiting, Tom," it said, and turning, Jingleberry saw the unquestionably real Marianne standing in the doorway. "No," he answered shortly. "I have had a very entertaining 10 minutes, but I must hurry along, Marianne," he added. "I only came to tell you that I have a frightful headache, and, I can't very well manage to come to dinner or go to the opera with you tonight." "Why, Tom," pouted Marianne, "I am awfully disappointed. I had counted on you, and now my whole evening will be spoiled. Don't you think you can rest a little while and then come?" "Well, I want to, Marianne," said Jingleberry, "but to tell the truth, I really am afraid I am going to be ill. I've had such a strange experience this afternoon. I... "Tell me what it was," suggested Marianne sympathetically. And Jingleberry did tell her what it was. He told her the whole story from beginning to end, what he had come for, how he had happened to look in the mirror, and what he saw there. And Marianne listened attentively to every word he said. She laughed once or twice, and when he had done, she reminded him that mirrors have a habit of reversing everything. And somehow or other, Jingleberry's headache went, and, well, everything went. The End of A Quicksilver Cassandra by John Kendrick Bangs. Read by John Taylor, Southeast Missouri, September 2006.
Well, that's it now. I'm going to close up the show with some music as usual. And, oh, I would like to mention that there's a new thing here at Night Transmissions. There's a blog. It's a WordPress blog. And rather than giving you the rather long URL for the blog, I'm just going to tell you that if you go to www.nighttransmissions.com, one word, no space between the night and the transmissions, no underscore, nothing, just one word, you'll find a link to the blog. The nice thing about this blog is that you can actually, if you wish, leave comments about this week or really any week's show or my personal hygiene.
Moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beauty. One by one, the guests arrive. The guests are coming through. The open-hearted many, the broken-hearted few. And no one knows where the night is going, and no one knows why the wine is flowing. Oh, love, I need you, I need you, I need you, I need you now. I need you now. And those who dance begin to dance, and those who weep begin. And welcome, welcome, cries a voice, let all my guests come in. And no one knows where the night is going, and no one knows why the wine is flowing. Oh, love, I need you, I need you, I need you, I need you now. I need you now. And all goes stumbling through that house in a lonely secrecy. Saying, do reveal yourself, for why hast thou forsaken me? And no one knows where the night is going, and no one knows why the wine is flowing.
What's the matter with you, my lass? And where?
picked him up and sent him far, far from me. Last payday he went off to town, and them red-coated fellows enticed him in and made him drunk, and he'd better gone to the gallows. The very sight of his cockade, it sets us all a-crying, and me, I nearly fainted twice. I thought that I was dying. My father would have paid the smart, and he ran for the golden guinea. But the sergeant swore he'd kiss the book, so now they've got young Jimmy. When Jimmy talks about the wars, it's worse than death to hear him. I must go out and hide my tears, because I cannot bear him. A brigadier or grenadier, he says they're sure to make him. But aye, he jibes and cracks his jokes, and begs me not forsake him. As I walked o'er the stubble field, below it runs the seam, I thought of Jimmy Ewing there, but it was all a dream. He hewed the very coals we burn, and when the fire eyes leeting, to think the lumps was in his hands, it sets my heart a-beating. So break my heart, and then it's o'er. So break my heart, my dearie. For I lie in the cold green grass,